This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The Olympics are a few months off yet, but the controversy surrounding China policy towards Tibet has been front page news for weeks. International protests, violence in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa, and the Chinese seem to believe that it's all the work of one dangerous troublemaker.
True happiness comes from a sense of inner peace, which in turn must be achieved through the cultivation of love and compassion.
A 72-year-old Buddhist monk who's lived most of his life in exile outside of Tibet, which China has controlled since 1950. And during the last couple of decades, the Dalai Lama has become a kind of superstar in the West. My friend Pico Iyer, the essayist and novelist, has known the Dalai Lama for years, and he's just published a new book about him and his exile called The Open Road. Pico's father was a philosophy professor who'd met the Dalai Lama back in 1960, and they'd become friends.
When I went back to India for the first time to meet my uncles and aunts and grandparents and cousins whom I'd never met, my father decided that part of the program would involve meeting the Dalai Lama. And of course, like any 17-year-old boy, the last thing I wanted to do was to meet a colleague or a fellow philosopher of my father's. I just wanted to meet Jackson Brown or Jerry Garcia.
The 70s, I guess?
1974.
Uh-huh.
So we got into the overnight train from Delhi, arrived in this little town in northern India, took a four-hour taxi ride, winding around the zigzag curves up into the foothills of the Himalayas. And as I recall it, maybe fancifully, we drove to the last little house on the road, small, modest yellow cottage, rang the doorbell, and went to see the Dalai Lama. Not many people were calling on him then. And I suppose the thing that I remember most vividly now is that although there were very heavy monsoons usually in Dharamsala, that day there was no rain, but there was heavy mist everywhere. So we sat in his audience chamber that has huge picture windows looking out on the valley below, and all I could see was clouds everywhere I looked. And it really felt as if these two philosophers were sitting on a mountaintop above the clouds, talking about emptiness and reality and compassion and other things.
Yes, we've seen that New Yorker cartoon, haven't we?
We have, yes. And I was determined at the age of 17 to imagine myself in a New Yorker cartoon. And certainly no sign of the real world as I conceived of it then around me. And I little guessed that 5 years later the Dalai Lama would be making his first trip to this country in 1979 and would be as deeply in the real world as anyone around.
And did you stayed in touch serially over the years with him?
I did. Somehow or other, that early teenage meeting had sown a seed in me whereby I was interested to learn more about this faraway culture. And as soon as Tibet opened up to the world in 1985, I went to visit it and ever since have been going back very, very often to talk to him and to see how and where he stands.
What is it like to hang out with him? Is it all discussions of geopolitics in the great game and existence, or what are you talking about?
What you notice when you talk to him first is he seems much more eager to learn and to listen than to speak. And secondly, when he starts speaking, he always refers to his other teachers and I think presents himself more as a student than as a wise man. He, in fact, refuses to take students himself and says what he wants are just spiritual friends, if you're so inclined.
And what about his ordinary human curiosities? What does he read, watch, listen to? Give me some Time magazine color on the fellow.
I remember years ago he told me that he was addicted to something. And I thought, what could the Dalai Lama be addicted to other than impermanence or non-attachment or something monastic? And he told me he was addicted to the BBC World Service. Every morning while he wakes up or as he wakes up and he does 4 hours of meditation, he has to listen to the news. And he says that if he's traveling and he can't hear the news, he really feels bereft. Something is missing from his life. And you're right, he reads Time and Newsweek and the daily newspaper, I think, more rigorously than I and most journalists I know. And he does have that almost omnivorous, voracious curiosity. If I'm standing backstage with him and he's about to give a lecture in Japan even, all he wants to do is go around the soundboard and ask the guy, you know, what's this button for and what are these lights and how can I work this? You know, he's famous for one of his hobbies is taking watches apart and reassembling them. And I think that speaks for what he's doing with the mind and with most things in the world. He loves seeing how things work, taking them apart, and then putting them back together again.
So highly worldly and empirical.
Empirical. And I think the metaphor that I have in my mind is that of a doctor traveling around, making a kind of global house call, and then seeing what he can offer. And usually he says, like a doctor offering prescriptions, maybe this will help. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, throw it out and find some wiser person to listen to.
But what sort of prescriptions in that instance does he offer?
For example, that you can make your life comfortable by changing the way you see the world. And as you know, I am a lifelong exile and a traveler. And I think when I've thought of the word exile, I've usually thought of loss, disruption, severance from the past. He says, well, exile can be opportunity. It actually can be a chance to slough off everything you didn't like in your previous life, or in his case, in old Tibet, and to make a much better, more grounded future. Another thing that has hit me a lot in recent weeks that I think I've picked up from listening to him is that you can care and speak passionately for Tibet without denigrating the Chinese.
Uh-huh.
Be pro-Tibetan but not anti-Chinese. The last time I saw him a few months ago, he said Tibet has a lot to gain from being part of China, that Tibet is a poor, materially backward place. We're glad to be part of this thriving, fast-moving nation, but we shouldn't have that at the cost of our basic freedom.
He has used the provocative phrase cultural genocide to describe what China is doing. What does he mean by that?
I think he means that China, especially during the Cultural Revolution, but still in the years since, has gone out of its way to try to destroy Tibetan religion. But you have this interesting thing in Tibet that's always struck me, which is almost two different visions of liberation. The Chinese, and understandably, regard liberation as meaning freedom from poverty, freedom from material backwardness. They're going to bring Lhasa and Tibet into the 21st century. But of course, for Tibetans, traditionally, as good Buddhists, freedom really means liberation from ignorance, liberation from suffering, a much more fundamental thing. The last time I saw the Dalai Lama, somebody asked him about modernity. And instantly, in the philosopher that he is, he said, what do you mean by modernity? There's a modernity of goods and facilities and opportunities, which is a great thing, but there's a modernity of values which may not be so good. Mm-hmm. In other words, at the realm of values, the old may have just as much to offer as the new, and perhaps even more.
And he, to that point, he has spoken with sort of nuance about this bullet train that the Chinese have built into Lhasa, and saying it's not bad in and of itself. It's just what it implies for the Tibetan way of life that could be bad.
Exactly. People often ask him, what do you feel about the amusement park that the Chinese have constructed outside your former home, the spiritual symbol of Tibet, the Potala Palace? He says, fine, no problem. That's there. Can't do anything about it. Maybe that's serving some good. But let's not get distracted by the surface changes from what is much more fundamental, which is that people in Tibet are still liable to be put into prison just for carrying a picture of their exiled leader.
Do you, or does he, have the sense that the net result of this current moment of turmoil and attention will be to the good? Is he optimistic?
He's always optimistic in the long term, but he's also shrewd and practical. And from many months now, well before the recent disturbances, he's been saying the really important thing is what happens after the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
This September, when we in the U.S. are thinking about the economy or the war in Iraq or certainly about the presidential election, that's when, after the Olympics are over, China can, as it were, execute its policies more ruthlessly than ever before, and none of the rest of the world is going to care.
Why do you think this Buddhist monk and Tibet have become so compellingly popular, for lack of a better word, among Westerners?
He might say that many Westerners and people around the world are reaching out to Tibetan Buddhism for something that they're not getting from their own system. But one of the striking, disarming things about the Dalai Lama is that when he travels around the world now, he more and more urges people not to take up Buddhism. Mm-hmm. If he were in New York tomorrow, he would tell a large audience, please don't turn to Buddhism too quickly without understanding it, without appreciating some of the cultural aspects that are very foreign to your tradition. Take what is useful and human from it that you can, but please work within your own tradition where your roots are deepest and where there's much less danger of misconception.
And you haven't. You don't consider yourself a Buddhist.
That's right. One thing that I learned from him is that Buddhism involves hard work, and it's not something you can pick up while being a dilettante, as I am, or while traveling around the globe, or while being interested in other traditions. And so in this book, I think I took pains really to write for the non-Buddhist who doesn't want to become a Buddhist, but who may learn certain things, even about globalism or politics, from this monk.
Obviously, he's a friend and a great model of a way to live one's life. Has he ever given you very specific advice, like, no, marry the girl, or move there, or anything like that?
He would, and he's extremely specific in his advice. And although he hasn't offered it to me, your question is very apropos, because I took my Japanese wife to meet him on our honeymoon. We went to India, and I thought one of the best things I could do with her was introduce her to the Dalai Lama. And she, who's much less reserved than I am, instantly asked him a question. She said, you know, my brother cut me and my parents 10 years ago. He's still living nearby, but he has nothing to do with us. What can we do with that? And he turned to me, and he said, you can intervene in this situation. And I said, do you mean because I'm not part of this feuding family? And he said, yeah, and also you're not Japanese, so you're not bound by certain rules of protocol. So he's very happy to give the most practical advice, though he's also equally happy to say, I don't know. And many people come to him with questions about their married life or even about their sexual life. And the first thing he says is, why are you asking a celibate monk? I'm the last person to, I'm the worst authority in the world on those kind of subjects.
Pico Iyer, I want to thank you very much.
Great to talk to you again, Kurt. Thank you.
Pico Iyer's book about the Dalai Lama is called The Open Road, and it's in bookstores now. Coming up, we take a pair of the country's most sophisticated noses on a smell safari.
Ooh, it's very odd.
Oh, that's
the boiled onion.
I hate that smell.
See, I rather like it.
Really?
Unlocking the mysteries of the deodorant aisle. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.